Session number 12778.
General Martin, Reel 10.
The fantastic sight of great formations of planes and gliders passing over on their way to Arnhem. The task of 50 Div was to follow up behind 43 Div in the Guards Armoured Division, heading for a link-up with the paratroops at Arnhem. And I remember that I was told that our task, once we'd passed through Arnhem, was to occupy, that 50 Div would occupy an area now Appledorn, from which it would be possible to outflank the enemy in on their positions on the Rhine. And so we would be striking eastwards from Appledorn into Germany. The next 10 days were are a bit difficult to sort out exactly, because the initially we were left behind in the bridgehead area while 43 Div went forward, and then at various times the road between ourselves and Nijmegen was cut, and there were operations that had to take place to clear the road again. We saw a further enormous air flight of gliders on the 23rd of September, I think it was, pass over, which I think must have been the Polish brigade. We knew that the airborne troops had actually captured the bridge at Arnhem, but were having a terrible time. We knew that 43 Div were pressing on as hard as they could. We ourselves, as we went forward, came across the Americans, airborne troops who had captured the bridges at a place like Grave, and that was a very impressive sight. And eventually we got up into the Nijmegen area itself. And sadly, the airborne operation had to be called off, and we were given the task of taking up defensive positions in the area between Arnhem and Nijmegen, which to us became known as the island. There was some very heavy fighting, the brunt of which fell on 69 Brigade to clear that area. Places like Holderen, I can remember being in, and Bemmel, I can remember being particular places. And then there we were, stuck in this area of the island from the end of September until about the end of the first week in November. We were in defensive positions. We had a coordinated divisional machine gun fire plan again for the first time since Sicily. It was very monotonous. It got wetter and wetter, and the island being very low, the land very low, any slit trenches rapidly filled up with water, and we had to get 44-gallon oil drum barrels for people to stand in inside their trenches to keep themselves dry. We tried to make ourselves as comfortable as possible by moving into houses and farms. The local people were still living there in quite large numbers, and my own company headquarters was adjoining a farmhouse where the people were wonderfully friendly. to such an extent that when we eventually moved just for Christmas, they were heartbroken. And I was told that the reason was because they were, had been fattening their cat up to present to us as a Christmas, in lieu of Christmas turkey. For that reason, we left before that could happen. It became possible for people to go off on short periods of leave. I went off for 48 hours to Brussels with Tony Mello in his captured Mercedes car, in which he then proceeded to drive into the back of an RAF three-tonner in bad visibility and rain, which meant we were both written off temporarily. Lieutenant Wood was detached from me to start a divisional recreation centre at the Colonial Barracks in Nijmegen. We got some football going. We managed to get people out of the line for some time to play football. And, of course, we wondered constantly what the next thing was that we were going to do. And we were told by the commanding officer that the next phase was going to be the attack on the Breisgau Forest down towards the Rhine, and that was going to be an extremely unpleasant job, but that 50 days once again would be called on to bear the brunt. However, that didn't worry us unduly, and and then we were told that was cancelled and that there was a new plot for us. And then morale charts began to appear as people began to wonder whether in fact we were going to go home. Rumours from the clerks at battalion headquarters started to arrive, saying that we were destined to go home. And I was sent for to a commanding officer's conference and told that this was exactly what was going to happen. We were going to be pulled out of the line, moved back to Belgium, where we would have our hand over all our transport and heavy equipment, and that we were then going to be reduced to a strength of 12 officers and 109 soldiers from the whole battalion, and sent home to England to train surplus RAF and naval recruits as infantrymen for the Rhine crossing. And the reason was that it was considered that 50 Divs had not only done its stuff, but that its standard of training was now getting a bit shaky, rather than the lines that I described earlier. And that it was time somebody else bore the burden of the day. Well, this was fine, except for one thing, and that was that it meant that from my own company, only myself, the second in command of my company, and about 20 men would be left, and all the rest were going to be dispersed all around the countryside, having been retrained as infantrymen. And this, to me, was an appalling betrayal. We pleaded, Tony Mellon and myself, and the other company commanders, we pleaded with the commanding officer, Marco Keeling, to lodge an objection and say that we were quite happy to go on fighting, providing we could be kept together. And we didn't want to be relieved, and we didn't want to be sent back to England. And we were told that 9DLI were going to be kept intact, and they were going to go off as the motor battalion, as the motor battalion to one of the armoured divisions. But Marco Keeling was not prepared to question orders. He was a good regular soldier, and when you were given an order, however unpleasant it was, you had to obey it. and so he refused to intervene. And so for the next week or so, we had to go on planning for this reduction in the strength of the battalion down to 109 and the strength of our companies. We weren't allowed to tell the soldiers what was going to happen. And it was very, very disturbing and distressing. The only pleasant thing which took place during this time was a dance held by 151 Brigade Headquarters, to which had been invited all the most eligible Dutch girls in Nijmegen. And I can remember my partner for the night was called Anne-Marie Rutgen van den Luft, who was the daughter of the manager of Macintosh's Toffees for Holland before the war. And I always wondered what happened to the very glamorous Anne-Marie Rutgen van den Luft. However, at the end of November, a news was made official that we were going home. And, of course, a tremendous jubilation at that stage in the company at the thought of going home and being home for Christmas. And little did they know, poor chaps, what lay in wait. So we moved back, handed over to another division, and moved back to a town called Izegem in Belgium. And here we spent a fairly alcoholic time, I seem to remember, and we handed in all our equipment and so on. During that time there was this German offensive in the Ardennes, and whereas the soldiers were hoping that we were not going to be turned around and sent back into the line again, I was hoping very much we would be, because that might be some means of saving the battalion. I decided with Tony Mellor that there was only one possible way out, and that was that we knew that the MP for Chester, Colonel Basil Neild, was serving in the Jandrat Advocate General's Department with 21st Army Group. We didn't know how much influence members of Parliament had in wartime, but the only thing we could think of was to try and see him and see if he would intervene. And so, without telling the commanding officer, I set off one day from Izegem. And I drove, I think, I can't remember where 21st Army Group was then, but wherever it was, I arrived there, only to find that Basil Neild was serving in rear 21st Army Group, which meant that we had to go, I think, back to Burg Leopold or somewhere like that. A long, long journey. Anyhow, I think it was Burg Leopold, right back down, all the way down that we had advanced from originally in Operation Market Garden. And we arrived at 21st Army Group Maria at supper time, and we managed to get Basil Neil out of the officer's mess to come and talk to us and explained the whole situation to him, that we had been together as a battalion through all this fighting in from Dunkirk to North Africa and to the invasion of Sicily, right up to Nijmegen, Normandy landing, and that we felt that we were betraying our soldiers by allowing the battalion to be broken up and for most of them to be sent off to other battalions to fight the final battles of the war. That people could last out as long as they were with their friends, but to send them into units they had never seen before, as strangers, and expect them to fight out the final battle of the war was too much. And he entirely took the point and promised to do what he could. And we felt that we had done all we could ourselves. And eventually we had, Bethlenil sent me a copy of a letter he'd had from, I think it was Lord Nathan, who was the minister, or one of the ministers for war, saying that much as he would like to help, he couldn't. We had one final fling. One of our officers who had got an MC and was having it presented by Monty agreed to tackle Monty while the medal was being handed over, which he very bravely did, and was told to shut up by Monty. And so, just before Christmas, we all disappeared home to Yorkshire, and the whole battalion together. Everyone then went off on leave, and I think at that stage the soldiers' main concern was Christmas leave, and what must happen after that was less of a worry. And I think a lot of them too felt the end of the war was practically there, and with any luck, by the time they'd been retrained as ordinary foot-slugging soldiers, and things might be over. But they came back after leave, and we, who had been their company commanders and so on, now had to train them as infantrymen, which we knew only of second hand, having watched the infantry at work. We got one or two infantry instructors, and for 5 weeks they were trained, and then one awful day in, I think, early February, wearing the badges of some 87 different units, off they went. And some went straight off to battalions in the front line, and some went holding units, and some were sent out to the Far East. But it's something which I have never forgotten, the shame of Mark O'Keeling allowing that happen has been with me for the rest of my life. I know that a great number got killed in the final battles of the war, and that I think was unforgivable. However, we were then joined by, up in Helmsley in Yorkshire, we were joined by a whole lot of trained infantry instructors, and the next gaggle we got was some 600 soldiers, sailors and airmen, who, much to their disgust, find themselves being trained as infantrymen for the Rhine crossing. And the only advantage of having them, or the only fun of having them, was that amongst them, we had representatives from every First Division Association football club, and we had the best battalion football team we'd ever had in our lives. And the same applied to the other battalions in the division. I remember a sort of epic football match with the Hampshire Regiment, which we won eventually 7-5. But otherwise it was bleak weather and snow, and the water pipes all froze up, and we had used snow and boiled snow for water. And I got shingles, which I was told to was due to the strain of the war, but I don't know what shingles were actually caused by at all. And we were still up at Helmsley when the news came of VE Day. And to us it was, we felt an incredible sense of um, disillusionment, not that's not quite the word, anticlimax. From the age of when I'd been 19, the German war had always been there, and suddenly it had disappeared. And one could see, couldn't see much point in existence any longer. The whole reason for being had suddenly disappeared too. And I can remember weeping that night. And I didn't think I was the only one in the division. I think it was a tremendous feeling of anticlimax. Well, what was going to happen next? We got rid of our airmen and our sailors, and we were told that the battalion was going to be reformed as a machine gun battalion and was going to go off to fight the Japanese. So Burma, when Europe's finished, was suddenly a live factor. We, of course, apart from the small cadre who had remained behind, the 12 officers and 109, it meant taking in entirely new soldiers who had not, most of them, been involved in battle before. But I felt I'd done my stuff, I must say. Fortunately, I was distracted at that time by courting very hard. So I felt it was also time I discovered what girls were all about after all this time. And so I had a swift and impetuous love affair, which, like most swift and impetuous love affairs, got nowhere in the end. But at any rate, I felt more reconciled at the end of that to going to Burma. We went down to Ashford in Kent, where we joined, I think it was called 60th Light Division. And 60th Light Division was to carry out initial training in the UK and was then to go to Texas to join an American corps. And we had very unrealistic training in sort of jungle warfare on the main roads down in Kent, with the divisional commander trying to impress on us that we could only use the road one way in the daytime and one way by dark. And if you wanted something out of a camp 2 miles down the road and broke the rules, there was tremendous penalties and so on. But fortunately then came VJ Day, and we wondered what the next thing would be in store for us. And then we were told that we were getting a new battalion commander, Colonel Dudley West, from the 4th Battalion, who had got an MC in Norway at the beginning of the war, but hadn't seen any fighting since, and that we were to be reformed down at the Hythe School of Infantry building in Hythe as a machine gun battalion to go to Palestine. And so at in December 1945, a year after we'd got back from the war in Europe, we set fair sail on HM Trooper Indrapura, bound for the Canal Zone, Portside, and then after a period of acclimatization, off to Palestine. We arrived in Palestine in March 1946. Before the battalion actually moved up there, I had a splendid skiing holiday in the Cedars of Lebanon at the Elephant Ski School run by the Army, followed by a good, very good shopping trip in Beirut. But by March 1946, we were in a camp at a place called Jalama, on the outskirts of Haifa, and on the edge of Mount Carmel. I see that in a letter I wrote home on the 9th of May, I said our camp is on the side of Mount Carmel, and our vehicle park is not far away from where Elijah used to garage his chariot of fire. I managed to do quite a bit of sightseeing, and as a result, my knowledge of the Bible has increased considerably, as it is, without being irreverent, quite the best guidebook. The Jews here are unpleasantly efficient and unpleasant. The Arabs are equally inefficient and correspondingly more pleasant people to deal with. I'm becoming anti-Semitic every day, and I should be annoyed if the Jews get their own way. What are really needed, I feel, are about 10 divisions here to really clean the country up, and then let the United Nations look after the country until the Arabs can govern it really efficiently. By all means, let 100,000 Jews in, but the majority should go elsewhere. There isn't room in Palestine anyway for the whole lot. So why deprive the Arabs of their own country for the sake of a few ambitious nationalists? Well, those were the thoughts of a 25-year-old, and I would think were fairly typical of the soldiers out in Palestine at that time.
In what specific ways were the Jews unpleasant?
Well, they had started to blow people up, ambush roads, shoot at soldiers, mortar camps and things like that. But one had only to look at the country which was in their control and see how the cultivation, how good it was and how efficient it was, and how run down and out of date the Arab lands were, to feel an admiration for what the Jews had produced out of the desert, but without liking them.
Were they unpleasant to you on a personal basis?
The one thing they couldn't avoid was propaganda. So you couldn't talk to a Jew without being constantly reminded about what they'd achieved. And if you were invited round to a settlement for supper or something like that, it would be non-stop propaganda all the time you ran there, and that used to annoy us a bit. But, as I say, we had a great admiration for what they had achieved. Felt sorry for the Arabs, but in another letter I say I have no great fondness for the Arabs either. I remember my wartime comments where I think that the Syrians were the best of the bunch. So this is the way one's feelings evolve.